So I think today I asked about people who were working on TT Bar who wanted to talk, and in addition to myself, I got 5 offers. And so I think we should regard these talks not as talks, but more of as an icebreaker. That is, people are going to stand up, and I'm going to be trying to keep them to actually 10 minutes, which means we won't have a lot of discussion, but they should be regarded as a chance to advertise. And then if you do a good job advertising, people will go and read your paper or come and ask you questions afterwards and try and understand what you're talking about. So don't feel bad about only getting 10 minutes. But try and advertise what you think the best thing of your model is, and maybe also mention, you know, the most problematic feature. And okay, so we should get started. And I think I have starting. I think we were starting with Ed Berger. Is that what I said? Yes. And he actually gave me some slides. Well, you should come up here.
Okay. Thanks very much. I've been warned that these have to be lightning fast talks, so I will
try to stick to the time. I want to talk to you a bit about some work that was done at Argonne with my collaborators there, published recently. This slide reminds you of what all the fuss is about. The data from CDF that show that there is a 3 or 4 standard deviation from the expectation of the standard model for the top quark asymmetry. More tops are produced in the direction of the proton beam than in the opposite direction. The standard model predictions are here. The asymmetry is maybe 3.5 standard deviations above the expectation of QCD. And the deviation is biggest at large invariant masses and large rapidity separation of the top and the anti-top. So there have been lots of attempts at beyond the standard model interpretations. The one I'm going to talk about has to do with a non-universal flavor changing neutral current exchange of a Z prime in the T channel here. So this diagram in which there's a Z prime exchange is a new physics contribution. It feeds the asymmetry. There's also an interference between that contribution and the standard model, which feeds the asymmetry, and then there's, of course, the standard model QCD contribution. I've drawn here the diagram in leading order, but obviously there's no asymmetry in leading order, so you have to have a next to leading order contribution in the standard model. The Lagrangian is shown at the top. The left-handed coupling is basically zero because it's constrained by BD-BD bar mixing. There's no coupling between the first generation and the second generation, otherwise you would have a tree-level contribution to DD bar mixing. All right, so it's non-universal, it couples the first and third generations. Now obviously if that diagram contributes in UU bar scattering at the Tevatron, then there's going to be a contribution in UU scattering at the LHC that's going to produce same sign tops. So the task we set ourselves was to use the Tevatron data on the asymmetry to determine the size of the right-handed coupling from the Tevatron data, and therefore to predict how many same sign tops we should have at the LHC. All right, so the constraints from the Tevatron are that obviously you want to try to fit the asymmetry, which is going to force the right-handed coupling to be large, in a sense. But you can't make it too big because you have to agree with the measured total cross-section. You can't exceed the standard model by more than a few standard deviations, and you want to get the TT bar invariant mass spectrum to be consistent with what's measured. Now, I showed you that that spectrum on the first on the previous transparency, and I won't go back to it. All right, so that's what we did. We took the data, we did a fit, and here's what we got. What we show you here is the right-handed coupling as a function of the Z prime mass. There are two bands that show the 1 sigma and the 2 sigma fits to the asymmetry and to the TT bar cross-section. These are the bands we extract from the Tevatron data, and we use those values of the right-handed coupling and the Z prime mass to predict the TT, same sign TT cross-section one should see at the LHC at 7 TeV and for 1 inverse femtobarn. So we have the 3 sigma prediction, the 5 sigma prediction, and the 100 event line. 5 sigma corresponds to about 10 events, right? Because the background is pretty small. It's about 1 event for the cuts that we chose. All right, so that's what one extracts from the Tevatron data. One more figure from the Tevatron shows the constraint that the Tevatron gives us on the same sign TT and T bar cross section. They have an upper limit of less than 0.7 picobarns, and one can use those results to further limit the bands, the uncertainty, the 1 sigma and 2 sigma bands. All right, so here are the data from the LHC. This is a paper that was produced very recently by the CMS collaboration. What they did was to look for same sign TT events. They're looking for tops that decay into W's plus B's. They look for W's that decay into positively charged leptons. They put cuts on the momenta of the leptons and on the momenta of the B's. And they find 2 events in 35 inverse picobarns at 7 TeV, 2 events. They have a background of 0.9 plus or minus 0.6. So essentially consistent with background, but with 2 events and that background and the prediction of the cross section, which they can extract from our paper when we gave them the code, they produce an exclusion region here that excludes the whole region allowed by the Tevatron. All right, so CMS worked very fast on this. They produced an exclusion region. They basically say that this interpretation, the Z prime exchange interpretation, cannot be the complete explanation for the asymmetry at the Tevatron. So I conclude at this point by reiterating that there's an appeal to the flavor-changing neutral current exchange interpretation because it naturally produces tops at large rapidity. It produces an asymmetry at large TT bar invariant mass. So we fit the data at the Tevatron. We made a prediction for the cross-section at the LHC. CMS collaboration has already basically excluded this interpretation at the Tevatron. So, end of story.
Great.
Maybe I didn't use up 10 minutes?
At least you've got 2.5 minutes for questions. Huh. What's your next favorite idea?
Aren't there versions of this model where you can give the Z prime a charge or something? And
yes, I'll talk about that actually.
Yeah, I mean there are possibilities with W's, W primes.
Yeah, so we need to avoid having this be a neutral thing that can come into the bar.
And you know, it's possible that you know, this could be part of an explanation. It can't be the whole story. Michael.
Can you show again the slide where you showed the comparison of the spectrum, the TT bar invariant?
Yes.
So this is for a very light one, 200.
Yes.
And there's what looks like significant spectral distortion.
Yes.
So This goes away if you have a heavier Z prime?
It's changed. I didn't bring that figure, but I'm happy to show it to you, because I have such a figure, I just don't have it in my hand. What you're seeing here is a tilt that's occasioned by the fact that there's an interference term between these two contributions. And in order to compute that interference term, I'm assuming that the couplings are relatively real. And you get a negative interference, and it's basically very straightforward calculation. And so what that negative interference is going to do down here is take away cross-section, and it's going to build up cross-section. So. So you're right that
the stronger constraint, I mean, I don't want to beat a dead horse too much, but other people are concerned with this too. It's a stronger constraint to fit to the spectrum than to simply fit to the total cross-section.
Well, we fit to the total cross-section.
Yeah, but in principle, you could have, as we emphasize here, positive contributions in regions that are constrained that are maybe even two orders of magnitude smaller than the total cross-section.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's a struggle, right? And it's a struggle to get the model to fit. I mean, one thing I didn't mention at all, and if you just look, at the LHC data on TT bar that they measure from the dileptons and from leptons plus jets, those data by themselves are telling you that the same sign TT cross-section has to be something like at most a fourth of the TT bar cross-section, at most. I mean, for these, I'm talking about last year's data, 35 inverse Beaker mines. And so just from the TT bar measured cross-section done in two different ways, you get a constraint on how big same sign can be. So and we didn't even fold that into the calculation, but it just is another nail in the coffin, if you like.
Well, as you said, you can fix up the same sign problem, but you still have this problem to worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Thanks. Brian?
I have the microphone on.
You have experience.
It makes sense for me to hear this, but that's what Brian's talking about. But I'm also talking about this,
model independent forms.
Then maybe it makes sense for me to talk next time, actually. Well, it's up to you, but since I'm more or less talking about the same thing, so.
Exactly. All right, so since we just had some discussion, actually mostly was going to talk Blackboard, but then just show a couple of slides that actually are closely related to what Michael was asking. I think I'll be fine just for this. The screen time's fine. Unless people over there can't see. So, all right, so I think this may be the requiem for three papers. All right, so.
You wanted shortcuts.
Yeah. So, this was work done with Sung-Hoon Jung, who is a student of James Wells, and this first paper was also with Satoshi Murayama. And the idea of this first paper was essentially the idea that Ed just talked about, which was to take advantage of this Rutherford singularity to have just the 1/4 sine to the fourth theta over 2 to get the strong enhancement in the forward region, and to use that to get your asymmetry. So that was the simple idea. And the one thing that we considered that was a little bit different than perhaps the simplest thing that Ed described was also the possibility that in addition to having a coupling that connects the U to the T, there could be a small coupling potentially that couples flavor diagonally as well. And this potentially is of interest because there are diagrams that have a glue and say a U in the initial state and produce the Z prime. And if the Z prime is lighter than the top or very close in mass to the top, even a very small coupling of this UU bar type will cause you to decay to light jets rather than back to a T. And this is potentially relevant for the same sign stop story because this is one of the diagrams that can contribute to same sign top. If the Z prime doesn't remember whether it came from top or anti-top, it can equally decay to top or anti-top here, and then you can get a contribution to same time top from diagrams that look like this. So that's one reason you might like such a coupling. Another reason actually is that this contributes negatively to the asymmetry, this kind of diagram, because here this top does not follow the U direction. It's actually tends to go in the other direction, so this actually gives a small negative contribution to the asymmetry. So if your goal in life is to get a big asymmetry, you would actually like to suppress this kind of diagram. So one thing that's potentially non-minimal as an ingredient you can add to these models is this kind of coupling. The effect of that actually is interesting. One of the effects is that the cross-section that you would measure in TT bar in the lepton and jets channel would actually be larger than the cross-section that you would measure in the dilepton channel, because this kind of event actually passes most of the cuts for the lepton plus jets channel. And so in the sample that they use to measure the cross-section, they don't always completely reconstruct the tops. And so you could get some pollution of that sample and get a somewhat larger cross-section here than here because this guy's not going leptonically. And so a prediction of this kind of model where you have this small additional coupling is that you would actually measure different cross-sections here and here. And it's not, it was certainly consistent with the Tevatron data with the way things are looking from preliminary data from the LHC. I'm not holding out much hope, but one prediction of these kinds of models would be that you would get precise measurements of these cross-sections, then this kind of difference would persist. Okay, so that's kind of what I wanted to say about the first paper. The wrinkle of the second paper goes to what Steve was asking about, which is, can you just charge the Z prime? And so we had a simple model.
Is there any evidence for the difference in the cross-section in the...
Is there evidence for that? They do have slightly different numbers, but it's all they're all consistent with one another at the moment.
Within the errors,
yeah. So we had a, if you like, a model of SU2 of flavor, where you put U and T in a doublet, and confusingly, perhaps, we called W's the things that took you between U and T, but these W's are neutral. And Z is the thing that couples flavor diagonally between U and T and T. So T, the Z, what we call the Z prime, was the T3 generator of this SU2. And the nice thing about now this being a non-abelian model, this is the same idea that maybe we'll hear about later with having complex scalar representations, is just in the same way that gluons carry color, this guy can carry top number. And so you can eliminate the same sign top signal if this symmetry is unbroken, because now your W prime, if you like, carries top number along with it. And so if we looked back at this diagram over here, where I produced this, what would now be a W prime. This would be a W prime of U T bar, and so it would decay back to a U T bar here, and so I would not produce any same sign top from these kinds of diagrams. Similarly, actually in the usual Z prime model, you have this diagram without the bars here, which is one of the reasons that the LAC is so deadly. You want this diagram with the UU bar, goes to TT bar to explain the asymmetry, but if it's a U1 model, you get this one, which looks especially bad for the LHC because now you have two valence quarks. But in this model, where this is now a W prime, you don't have the diagram without the bars anymore, and so you've suppressed the same sign top. So this model has the feature of strongly suppressing the same sign top, but how much time do I have, Anne? Like 2 minutes? A minute? Depending on how much time I have, I'll present something else or not.
You want to see that plot that rules you out.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So let me first just say what the situation was for the Tevatron for this TT bar.
Off those light switches. Right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So at the Tevatron, here is the TT bar invariant mass spectrum. And one of the things that's interesting is, if you like, model C was there to show you that there's a region of parameter space that is bad. Model A was supposed to be what we thought was a good model. And naively, you would look at the spectrum and say, this looks horrible. I have something that does not fit, is not fitting at all. And this is what you would get if you did not take into account the acceptance cuts. But the point is that precisely for the same reasons that you get a large TT bar asymmetry, many of your events are going very forward. And that's particularly the case in the case of large TT bar invariant mass, because that's the case where you really are getting this 1 over sine to the fourth. And so there's a huge acceptance effect in this bin, and we did our best job that we possibly could of trying to model that acceptance effect. And what we found was we went from the previous plot and to the two highest bins now looking something like this, where they agreed actually quite well. So at the Tevatron, we felt like we actually reproduced this MTT bar and variant mass spectrum very well. And then we had a prediction for this model. If you like this SU2 model, let's talk about that now. And the previous plot was for that as well. And this is supposed to be the ratio of the cross-section as a function of the TT bar invariant mass in our model to the standard model. And you can see that as you get up to very large invariant masses, there's a huge effect on the cross-section. And these two curves are, if you don't have place any acceptance cut, and this is some kludgy attempt on our part to mock up the fact that these detectors have finite acceptance. And while it's not exact, I will say that if I look at this, and unfortunately if I blew up the scale much more, you would say that, okay, in this region from 1,000 to, say, 1,200 GeV, I would say there is probably something like a 20% enhancement in the cross-section. And you can now go to this plot that came out a couple of weeks ago, and you can look at the bin between 1,000 and 1,200, and you can see that we're not really looking like there is a 20% enhancement. So I would say that the status now of these Zoot models is that while you can solve relatively easy the same sign top issue, I don't have a simple solution to this invariant mass spectrum idea.
Do we think there's enough? We can include some standard model theory uncertainty.
Well, there's an issue of just the shape, and so
standard model uncertainty doesn't apply to the shape.
I don't think it applies as much to the shape. I mean, maybe someone who's more expert on these types of NLO calculations would have more to say. But I would think that. I mean, I just picked a thing where it was really obvious, where I thought the statistics are very obvious. But I mean, you could see that my deviations were even larger out here, and there still have a few events there. Now I'd be predicting a factor of a few more than what they see. So I do think it looks really pretty bad.
This is probably a pretty generic issue for all these.
This is probably a pretty generic issue for any of these T-channel exchange models, I'm afraid. So I'll comment. It's also less interesting now, both in light of this and perhaps another data. We could explain half of the WJetJet. The preferred mass that one of the preferred mass region we liked was between sort of 160 and 200 for this model. And if you took the 160, sometimes you would get the wrong jets, and it would actually give you sort of the right the bump in the right region, but with half the cross section that CDF has saw. So I guess if you want to average D0 and CDF, you're in good shape. But given this, I'm a little bit less interested. And that was actually what this paper was about. Here, so. Okay, so let me stop there.
The other place where they could do pretty well, actually, they have talked to us a little bit, but maybe they won't care given this thing that maybe already does it. This is actually single top, because you have another big source of single top.
I'm just plugging another model into this analysis.
Yeah.
So actually, you want me to skip that one, right?
The NYU has talked about sort of recasting these analyses in light of our models.
If you have an idea of what you can get through in 10 minutes.
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. Okay, so I just wanted to say a few words about a study that I mentioned last time we talked about this, which I did with MC et al. And O, although you'll see it's a study where I reweight the events to introduce a CDF type asymmetry to see what you could see at the LHC in some not fully, but maybe moderately model-independent way in terms of the asymmetry itself, rather than looking for bumps or different kinds of final states. So, okay, we'll skip that, I guess, and also, but let me just say what I did to model it. So, MC at NLO, of course, is a next leading order Monte Carlo, so it does include the asymmetry and the standard model amount. And I just show here, this is MCFM, so this is the analytical calculation, and here's the MC at NLO with some statistical fluctuations is quite consistent with it. But when you apply the acceptance cuts, which of course you can't do in MCFM because you don't have a full simulation of the final state, then you find that the asymmetry goes down by about a factor of two. And we have to bear that in mind because the CDF data are after acceptance cuts, the so-called data signal shown is after cuts. So what I did was take the MC at NLO output events and reweight them with a function of delta y of the T and T bar. So the difference, hyperbolic tangent, more or less translates into cosine of the center mass angle as shown in the diagram up there. And then a coefficient which increases linearly with the TT bar mass so that you get an enhancement like this. And so before cuts, it's above their so-called data signal, but after cuts, it's pretty consistent with their data. And this shows the low mass and high mass bins showing that you get consistency with their data with this hacking of the standard model. So, well, what can we do at LHC? Well, of course, the LHC, I think I've gone two slides here, yeah. So the LHC is a PP machine, of course, and so it's actually dominated by glue goes to TT bar, as shown by this. So again, before cuts, and the cuts I've applied here are sort of the standard TT bar cuts that the LHC experiments use for this channel. That's one leptonic and one hadronic decay, and you see it's dominated by glue, although that's in the central region, and then QQ bar is lower, but it's bigger in the forward and backward regions, of course, because that's where you get a valence quark. And indeed, if you go to large positive rapidity of the TT bar system, then you know that it's most likely that that it's a fast quark and a slow anti-quark, a valence quark and a and similarly in the backward region, so that what you expect to find is an asymmetry over here, which is throwing the top quark in the forward direction, and over here it's throwing the top quark in the backward direction, and therefore you get an asymmetry, which is now a function of YTT bar, just a monotonic function of YTT bar. And it's actually dominated by, as you can see, it's dominated by UU goes to UU bar goes to TT bar. So of course, again, so here's the asymmetry as a function of delta y between the T and the T bar. So that's the difference of rapidities plotted against, essentially against the sum of the rapidities. So what we're looking for is just an increasing slope here, and the standard model doesn't show a significant effect. This is for two inverse, roughly two inverse femtobarns, so sort of this year's run. I did do an extra cut on four jets. I demanded exactly four jets in the final state, and this was to try and suppress the glue-glue, because if you have glue-glue, then you tend to get more initial state radiation, so you tend to get more extra jets in the final state. And we'll see that that has some effect if the CDF data are correct. So here's what happens. Let's see, what have I done here? This is now for MTT bar bigger than 500. So this is the high mass region. So in the standard model, you're starting to see an effect, but it's actually not statistically significant at this level. And then I put in this hack of the standard model, which is consistent with the CDF data. And now you see this magenta curve, which is the, so this is the with the standard cuts and then the extra cut of four jets in the final state. Then you see a significant effect. And in fact, if you compare the forward and backward TT bar rapidity regions, then the two bins are different by about 3 sigma. If you make that cut according to this fairly crude but full Monte Carlo simulation that I did. So my conclusion, of course, you can argue, I mean, different models, obviously, like the T-channel models, don't simply give you cos theta. They give you something which is thrown more in the forward and backward direction, so there'll be a slightly different effect there. On the other hand, in those models, you have to fight with the depend with the modification of the spectrum, which this thing doesn't modify the spectrum. You can argue about whether it's UU bar or DD bar that will affect. I've just applied the same hack to all the QQ bar collisions to give this this result, but it looked fairly promising to me. Now, what CMS have actually done is they are, and obviously they're accumulating statistics. This is the 36 inverse picobarns preliminary result on the difference between the modulus of the rapidity of the T and the T bar. Now, maybe I ought to just do that on the blackboard so you can see that it's equivalent to what I was showing. Let's see which one. Yeah. So what you should be looking for is a positive bias in these plots, and maybe if you're optimistic or imaginative, you can already see something emerging. Anyway, as I was saying, I think it should be significant at the end of this year's run. And the point is you're looking for they're looking for an expectation value. Actually, they do pseudo rapidity, but it doesn't really matter too much. Although, don't really see why you do pseudo rapidity for tops. So they're looking for this bigger than zero. Now, that's the same as demanding yt squared minus yt bar squared bigger than zero, and that's the same thing as demanding the sum times the difference. So they're looking for this correlation, which is exactly the one I showed you, where when the TT bar rapidity is positive, then the delta y is positive and vice versa, so that it's the same as the monotonic rise in the correlation that I showed before. So if you look at this plot, you're supposed to see eventually that the tops are being thrown forward and backward more than the antitops, and so this plot will be skewed over to the positive side. So these are the electron plus jets and muon plus jets samples, so that's two independent data samples that they can look at. Mine was for those combined, so I guess what I'm saying is that it might turn out that they wouldn't be separately significant on the basis of two inverse femtobonds, but they would give you about three sigma combined. Okay, so that's it, I guess. Oh, I had a conclusion, so I think.
Yeah. How model-independent do you think your hack is?
Well, I think given the acceptance that, you know, I've applied the acceptance cuts and so on, I don't think it depends terribly much on whether it's cos theta or some T-channel type of thing, but I guess I could run a hack that would simulate a T-channel exchange. Then you've got to worry about the mass and so on. But yeah, and then you'd have to worry about modifying the spectrum and all that stuff. So by the time you fitted the spectrum and everything, I suspect it's not too sensitive to the model.
One more question.
So Ben, how much luminosity LHC needs to clearly rule out the CDM?
Yeah, well, I say if two inverse femtobonds is three sigma, then you can figure it out, I guess. To rule it out, that would be three sigma. Well, if they're perfectly consistent with the standard model by the end of this year's run, then I guess nobody will get excited. Yeah. Yeah, Michael. Yeah.
So could you show again the plot of the rapidity distribution?
You mean broken down into gluons and quarks and things? Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the acceptance is a very significant effect because I mean there isn't any muon acceptance, for example, above the rapidity of 2, and all the forward top quarks are decaying in that region.
So my solid curves are after the cuts, which I think I have on my backup slides, if that I actually used. Yeah, those are the cuts I used. So I demanded that the lepton should go in delta eta of 2.5. You think that's too big? And a missing ET cut and so on. And I demanded two tag Bs, yeah. Sorry, yeah, but I'm not sure what tagging efficiency I used. I think, yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Okay.
Hello, I'm Gustavo. I'm from Boston University, and I'm going to tell you about a light taxi gluon as an explanation for the T2-bar asymmetry, which is work I've been doing with Martin Schmaltz. I guess this we have already seen, so let me jump back to the model. We want to use a light taxi gluon, which is weakly coupled and has universal couplings to the standard model quarks as an explanation for the T2-bar asymmetry. So it looks like the diagram looks just like the gluon diagram in the standard model when you have QQ bar's initial state. And here I have drawn all the leading order contributions to the T2 bar production. Most important term is the interference one. That's the one that's going to give us asymmetry. We can see that because it depends on cosine theta. And it also has some interesting features, which is it changes sign once you are below or above the exiguo mass. And to remember that it does see some negative asymmetry in the low invariant mass beam, this is an interesting feature. And it's sort of maximally efficient in generating asymmetry, since the cosine theta term integrates to zero. So the interference term does not contribute to the total cross-section, and it does produce asymmetry. And down there is the new physics square term, but this one depends on the exigluon coupling to the fourth power, and therefore we expect this one to be small as long as we have a weakly coupled exigluon. The issue is that if this is not broad, then it would show up as a bump in the cross-section for the TT bar. So we better, even though we have it weakly coupled, we still need it to be broad, and we'll come back to that.
How light is light?
It's actually, we want it to be near the 450 GeV, so that's where the asymmetry goes from negative to positive. So it's that's the preferred region, between 400 and 450. So here are some plots that we do with this model. We have chosen to make those plots a mass of 420 GeV for the exigluon, and chosen parameters so that we get 30% asymmetry at leading order from just our model. So one could, in principle, would add up the next leading order prediction from QCD, and that would get you close to 40%, which seems fairly good. So we get those plots are for 20%, 15%, and 10% width. And you see as you go to lower width, it does give rise to a bump. So we would need to get, we would need an exigluon to be quite broad. And here we have a plot of the asymmetry as a function of the TT bar invariant mass. And it does have the interesting feature that it starts out negative but small. And then once you go through the exigluon mass, it rises very steeply and give you a large asymmetry in the high invariant mass beam. And this is just some values for an example point. So if you choose the, so in general we were thinking about a coupling about a third of the QCD coupling. That's what we call small, and which works out fairly well if you have the exigluon between 400 and 450 GeV. And with those parameters, we can get a minus 0.05 asymmetry in the low invariant mass beam, a 0.3%, 30% asymmetry in the high invariant mass beam. And the change in the we computed the total cross-section, and we get a change of 8% if we compute everything to leading order only. So those seem to be within the uncertainties. Well, so even though a light exigluon with weak couplings and with a large width seems a good explanation for the TT bar asymmetry, one has to build a model that where you can implement all those things. So this is a general way of getting an exigluon to have the SU3 of color be SU3 left cross SU3 right that gets broken to the diagonal, and you impose parity symmetry here in order to get axial couplings. The only problem with that is that you get the coupling of the exigluon equal to the QCD coupling, and so that's not small. So one has to introduce some new features in order to get a small coupling. One way of doing that is you can introduce heavy vector-like quarks that are partners to the standard model ones. And those quarks mix with the standard model ones, and through this mixing, you can dilute the coupling. In fact, introducing psi as the mixing angle between those fermions, you can get anything between zero and the QCD coupling. So that's a way of getting the exigluon coupling to be small. But if you have a small coupling and no light state, then you would have a narrow resonance for your TT bar. So we would also need to include some new light states, which are better be not ruled out yet. And one reasonably safe thing to do would be to introduce these new colored scalars. And those scalars can decay to gluon jets, and therefore you would have, well, you would reproduce quite a few exigluons if you want to explain the TT bar asymmetry, and then you would have them decay to four gluon jets. and as long and dedicated search for jets. If you don't have a B jet, we are not aware of anyone that has done this, so it seems a relatively safe channel. Another alternative would have to use one of the heavy quarks, and you get a coupling of heavy quark to light quark to the exigluon, and you can decay to that, which also gives a four jet final state. And yeah, so this would be how it would look like in a QQ bar production of the exigluon. At the LHC, you would be mostly pair producing those because it's a PP machine, so you would have to look at eight jet event final states. That's probably the better signature to look for such a light exigluon. And that's what I have prepared.
So Aaron told us that you can't have a deviation of more than 20% in the BIM. So is your model really below 20% in each BIM?
I think if you do it in the broader cases, I think so. But I mean, we didn't check everything yet. I mean, it's still ongoing work. But it seems that it's a small deviation in each beam.
The docking is a third.
At LHC.
Yeah.
Oh, the LHC. Oh no, it's more. I mean, it's mostly changes only close to the resonance. Yes. Because then it goes.
About the cis channel stuff compared to the T channel stuff.
But I mean. Percent
deviation
from 400 to 400.
And 400 is mostly glue at the LHC.
Oh, it's okay.
So
oh, yeah.
It's very small.
Tevatron's
probably the hardest thing to
set.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Could you look at the digest, the contact interaction type?
Yeah. So we did some plots for the digests here, and it's very small. So because it's fairly broad, so this would be the digest shape if you compute only leading order QCD, and because it has a factor of a third squared, so it's already
something about the chi distribution.
Oh yeah, we also looked at that. So thanks. Yeah, so we did. So this is all only computing things to leading order, and as long as the coupling is small. And it's relatively broad.
Sorry, what's this?
So this is looking at, yeah. So this is looking at digets, so with energy between 400 and 500 GV at the Tevatron, because we thought that this would be where we would be mostly in danger, since it's a QQ bar machine. And this is the chi variable that they used to study angular distribution for the digets. So this, you expect if you have a new, so most of the digests come from T-channel stuff, so they're, and the chi distribution is made, they do this chi distribution analysis because it's mostly flat at high chi, and what they expect to look is to see a lot of events at low chi, in the low chi, so you would have, and this blue curve would be QCD, and the green curve would be our model, so it doesn't seem to give a considerable change in the chi distribution.
Scalars, I mean, what they have masses, obviously similar to the top mass or something.
So, from what we have thought so far, they need to be heavier than 100 GV. Otherwise, when they decay, they would decay. The jets would be very close, so they would probably be identified as a single jet, and then they would also show up in the dijet, and this would hurt us. But as long as it's heavier than 100 GV, but not very heavy to constrain the phase space factor. We could have anything in that region, so not very close to the, not necessarily very close to the top.
So there's no gluon exigluon coupling.
No, there's no.
Because they impose this parity symmetry, isn't it?
Yeah. So.
Sorry, but that would force the exigluon coupling to be equal to.
Right, but they have mixing with heavy quarks, so the exigluon coupling to the light quarks is not.
Oh, so it's not okay.
But they keep the parity symmetry. But the parity symmetry is, you assume, is somehow broken but not communicated to this.
Yeah, so we didn't, we are still thinking about this part, but we expect it to be small. So one of the effects would be that it would introduce a small vectorial coupling, and yeah. If the exigluon has a vector coupling, it starts to should look worse in the shape of the TG bar. But we didn't quantify yet what how this, I mean, because of the SU2 and the Yukawa terms would break this. There are some alternatives for the Yukawa code. Okay.
Recent paper on the TT bar asymmetry, but I'm not going to talk about that. So I said I was going to talk about stuff I just started thinking about for a few minutes, so hopefully get some feedback. So I was somewhat inspired by the so-called effective Z-prime models that Fox, Gialude, Tuckersmith, and Weiner came up with. I don't know if people are familiar with those, but the basic point, I think it's motivated by the fact that even though we think if we have a new spin one particle, it should be a gauge boson, and therefore we should use gauge invariants to figure out its couplings, that actually didn't turn out to be true for the W boson. I mean, and which confused people historically because they had to understand quark mixing before they could understand that actually there was a universal coupling to the quarks. And I think the same thing is true if we'd govern a new gauge boson, such as a Z prime or an axi gluon, that because the particles we see may be mixtures of things which originally had different gauge couplings to those heavy gauge bosons, we should not expect necessarily simple gauge invariants to dictate how they would couple to, say, the Z prime or the axi gluon. So I was also motivated by some of the successes of axi gluon models, which have partially been negated by LHC constraints. But I did see one recent paper which said, well, if you could have an axi gluon but suppress its coupling to the light quarks and increase its coupling to the tops, you can still be consistent. And so let me just describe how one would build a model which started with gauge invariants and had nearly unrestricted couplings to the standard model, light quarks, different couplings to the third generation, no anomalies, and minimal flavor violation, which I think is where you'd want to start if you're going to start thinking about looking for axi gluons at the LHC. And I was also somewhat motivated by thinking that if there really is a new heavy spin one particle out there, one possibility for it is that it could be something like, you know, a technicolor or a rho particle. And we know for QCD that there are nice gauge descriptions of vector mesons in QCD motivated by, you know, ADS CFT and dimensional deconstruction and things like that. So as, anyway. With that introduction, let me just write down a model for an axi gluon, which can have arbitrary couplings to the light quarks and flavor symmetries. And I'll just illustrate it with the left-handed quarks. So if you have a spin one octet, which is heavy, a heavy gluon, if you want to start with gauge invariants, you would start with gauge group SU3 cross SU3, and the easiest way to get this thing to couple to quarks is to break to QCD, and then if you do a table of how things transform under the full gauge group, if you start with the standard model quarks, you want anomaly cancellation it's tricky once you start making the left and right hand ones transform into one and two. So let me first just introduce a generation of quarks that just transforms under SU3-1. So this is just our usual left-handed quarks. And then our right-handed quarks, or left-handed anti-quarks, U-bar and D-bar, also take the transform under SU3-1. But then, you know, this obviously wouldn't give you an axigluon, or because everybody would couple in the same way. So in order to get different couplings of the left and right-handed quarks, you would have to introduce some new particles. And if you want to keep anomaly cancellation in a simple way, it's easiest to introduce them in a vector-like representation. So everybody's left-handed in my notation, so they have opposite H numbers. And then we need to break a symmetry, so we would introduce a scalar, call it phi, that transforms under both. And then our standard model quark, it's actually not going to be either this guy or this guy, but a linear combination. So let me put primes on them, so I don't have to put primes on the standard model quark. And I'm now allowed to write down a mass term like this. And also a Yukawa coupling. Like this.
The S term must think the left hand.
So, what? Everybody's left-handed.
I'm sorry. I mean the doublet, not the singlet.
This is the mass term. This is an expectation about. So these do not break the standard model gauge group. Okay. This is just what's allowed before electroweak symmetry breaking, these terms. And then you have a heavy quark, which is a linear whose right-handed component is made from the Q bar and whose left-handed component is a linear combination of the Q prime and the Q prime. And you have a light quark, which, let me see, is cosine of some mixing angle, Q prime, plus sine of a mixing angle, a capital Q prime. And this will be some standard model quark. And now if you want to work out its coupling to the axigluon, and let me see, there's also going to be some axigluon analog of the weak mixing angle, the ratio of these two couplings. Let me call it tangent theta strong. Okay, some mixing angle here. And then the coupling of this guy is, well, it's essentially arbitrary. Cos squared alpha times the
top bottom is a light quark, a little q.
Little q is a linear combination of, so these guys are the guys with simple gauge representations, but the standard model particles we see are linear combinations.
He's asking, are all three generations of the standard model doing the same thing?
No. They don't have to. They could. I would, if I was going to keep flavor symmetry in here, I would multiply all of these by three so I could keep a flavor symmetry here. But actually, I wanted something different for the top, which is easy, because I could say, given that, you know, top is different with its large Yukawa coupling, just introduce it, do something different for top. That's easy too.
what I think is very behind the bulk.
So does top just have a different mixing angle? Or you
top, because the top would just have a different mixing angle, yes. If you wanted something different for top, and that is perfectly consistent with minimal flavor violation given its large alkali coupling. And then if everybody else has the same mixing angle, you would have, you know, very good flavor symmetry for flavor changing neutral current suppression.
Flavor changing neutral current is not automatic, right?
Yes, or flavor changing currents, they would only be hadronic, which is less constrained, but yeah, but in order, if you want to keep, if you want to avoid flavor changing neutral currents, it would multiply all of these particles by three generations and make these terms consistent with at least an SU2 subgroup of the SU3 generational thing that acted on the light two generations.
That in the gene basis, but if you produce eukalyl, you have to go in mass basis. I'm not sure that.
But that's, no, because it's almost the same, right? I mean, you have very small mixing angles between the generations.
Yes, but it's some effect is there, right? It's not.
Right, that's just like there's some effect, there's some flavor changing neutral currents already in the standard model because top is heavy, and these wouldn't be larger than that. Right. Okay, but anyway, so the coupling to the heavy gluon would just be, okay, you've got this mixing angle. Cos squared alpha times the tangent of the mixing angle minus sine squared alpha times the cotangent. Of the strong mixing angle. So in the sort of canonical Axe gluon model, G1 over G2 is taken to be 1. That's what the previous speaker was just doing. And left-handed quarks would be taken to have cos alpha 1, and right-handed quarks would be taken to have sine alpha 1. But you don't have to have just that canonical model. Right, and you can see you can have a different alpha for every quark or a different alpha for every, you know, type of quark maintaining flavor symmetry, and then the couplings to the Axe gluon basically are free parameters, still with a simple underlying gauge invariance. I think that's basically all I wanted to say for now. In response to questions, I also mentioned flavor symmetry and how I would want to break it in a way consistent with the pattern of the Yukawa matrices, namely keeping flavor symmetry for at least two generations. And indeed, due to small mixing with the third generation, there would be some small amount of flavor changing neutral currents.
Yeah, that flavor pattern should be doing something to protect in general.
I would say, assume the strong, I would like to say this heavy gluon, you know, the second gauge group was actually some sort of effective hidden gauge group of a strongly coupled sector with a strong coupling, and so this was really some kind of Roux meson-like thing. Yeah. And that strong group happened to have at least an SU2 flavor symmetry built into it, and so everything naturally came in multiples.
Otherwise,
yeah.
Usual
yeah.
Conflict,
right. Okay.
Is there any particular reason why you took the two primes to be electroweak doublets rather than doing the same?
Oh, no, you could do, you could also do this for these guys. I mean, anybody whose coupling you didn't want to take to be the canonical thing. I mean, I guess.
Just you might do better even with flavor. I don't know. If you say it's safe already, but you might.
Could introduce heavy vector like partners for each of these. You're then going to have, you know, basically triple the number of quarks, which,
well, I was thinking you just had partners for the right-handed top, you know, instead of these capital Qs, if you just had them partners for they're sort of partners of the left-handed.
All three generations. But you do need to do something with the light quarks. You can't leave them out because they do need to have some axial coupling to the Axe gluon, which they won't have if you don't do something for them. Yeah. Right, you can't just leave the light quarks out of it completely.
You might be able to impose more flavors.
We
found that you are really screwed if your couplings aren't exactly axial. And so that's why we imposed the parity symmetry. That's why we said G1 better be very close to G2. Because the shape of the TT bar spectrum get screwed up a lot. So for example, we did a plot, I mean, we...
If you're not exact...
Gustavo showed the plot, if you had our axial view and the broad axial view one with exactly axial couplings, and the shape looked okay. If you take exactly the same gluon but make its couplings vectorial, it looks 100%.
That was, what do you think would happen though if it was two TeV or four TeV instead of 450 GeV?
The high invariant mass TT bar spectrum is totally screwed up. Mm-hmm.
It is, right. I think
that's... You really want axial, and so that's why you want to mix your left-handed quarks and you want to mix the right-handed quarks in the opposite way with a parity symmetry, ensuring that those angles are the same thing.
Yeah. I think that's clearly possible.
I mean, we have the same...
And you also mix with heavy quarks in order to adjust your couplings. Yeah, but you're just trying to adjust everybody's coupling down.
Right, so I think you can do, you're doing the heavy axial gluon version of what we did with the light axial gluon. I think it will work if you have a parity, but it's really important to make sure you don't have any vector-like couplings of the axial gluon, because that hurts a lot in the shape of the cross-section. So you don't want to play just with the right-handed quarks, for example. That doesn't work at all.
Michael had a comment.
What fraction of right-handed current top decays do you have?
I mean, top decaying via the axial gluon?
No. So you mix the top with a double.
No. Oh. Okay. No. Everybody is mixing with things with the same SU2 crush U1 quantum numbers, although I guess one could allow mixing with things with different SU2 crush.
Well, on the blackboard, you have a mixing of the T-bar with the doublet Q-bar.
Which is also an SU2 doublet. There's nothing in that.
The T-bar.
I didn't do anything with the T-bar. Wait, the T-bar, the left-handed T-bar isn't doing anything so far.
I'm sorry. You criticized me the other way last time I asked this question.
I think there's a bar mixing on the 5, which I don't know if that's the problem. I think the bars are flipped on the 5 corner.
The 5 is a scalar.
But I know, but I think it should be 3 bar 3 rather than 3.
Oh,
five.
Probably.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not my problem. So the right-handed top quark in the model on the blackboard mixes with the doublet?
Right now the right-handed top quark isn't mixed with anything. In the model on the dark blackboard. Only the left-hand, what happens is the left-handed top quark, which is a doublet, mixes with another left-handed top quark, which is also a doublet, but which has a different coupling to the axial gluon. Okay, one could also allow mix, I mean, if the heavy quarks are very heavy, that should be how it would work. If you make the heavy quarks, you know, comparable in mass to the top quark, you could allow a more general mixing pattern.
So far you have massless standard model quark.
Right, and then you're going to put in a Yukawa coupling of the standard model quarks to the Higgs, which is consistent also with this model if I put in a Higgs. But that doesn't introduce any mixing yet between. I mean, eventually, I guess one would expect that the level of mixing between standard model doublets and standard model singlets, if you introduce these vector-like things, is of order standard model quark masses over heavy quark masses. So in the limit, the heavy quarks, even if the axial gluon was a TeV and the heavy quark masses were a TeV, that would be small mixings. But if you put in new quarks at the weak scale, you could have order one mixings. That's probably not good.
The limit of right-handed top decays is it's a few percent. It's surprisingly strong.
Right. You mean the fact...
Get out of it in many ways.
Well, I wasn't going to have any substantial right-handed top decays, but you're saying if the top mixed with something which... If the right-handed top mixed with something which was a doublet and could decay, that wouldn't necessarily be good. Yeah.
There are many ways that.
Yeah, it's easy not to have that. Anything else? All right. Thanks.
In fact, there is one more, I think. One more clock.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So, Anne, is the other model still alive?
As far as I know, it is. Except that we had this paper. That was not the correct paper. You mean the paper saying, criticizing the deep physics of the...
Sorry.
A model with the motivation of unifying the two CDF anomalies, which I wrote, which I no longer ask motivated to do as I used to. Oh.
There is still this dialecton D0. Light sign dialecton.
Light sign dialecton? Oh, yeah. That model, I did not have a model behind that.
But what, Catherine Zurich and Jesse Shelton had such a model?
Aren't they moved up by light sign?
Of discussions on the phenomenology of topos symmetry already. Next, I will try to address some questions on topos symmetry at the early LHC. The first question is, what is the sensitivity of measuring top charge asymmetry at the early LHC? Unlike the Teletron, the LHC is a PP collider. So it seems difficult to measure such a symmetry in this setup. But we know that the pattern distribution of valence quark dominant over that of the C quark. So in principle, we can still adapt the Teletron observable to a PP collider by selecting the boost direction of the TT bar system as a positive direction. In addition, we know that on the market, we have several competing models which are used to explain the Teletron anomaly. So the next question is it possible to distinguish these benchmark models at the early LHC at a significant level? These discussions are based on my recent work in collaboration with David Kran, Jesse Shelton, and Lian Tao Wang. Here are the strategies that we took for our analysis. We consider leptonically decaying TT bar events only. To distinguish these models, we introduce a group of leptonic observables. The first one is leptonic charge asymmetry. One nice feature of this observable is it is less correlated with the kinematics of the parent tops. The second one is top polarization. We consider top polarization in two cases, beam basis and helicity basis. We also introduce spin correlation. Also, two spin correlation observables. One is based on the top and the anti-top polarizations. And another one is based on lepton and anti-lepton arrhythmia angles. We did our analysis at hadron plus TT bar reconstruction level. In our analysis, we made a fully reconstruction for these TT bar events. As an illustration, we can set four benchmark models. Three of them are axis ground model. The last one is W prime model. For axis ground models, we can set three cases. Pure axial axis ground model, left-handed axis ground model, and the right-handed axis ground model. For these three cases, we keep the axis couplings the same and vary the vector couplings. In addition to the selection cuts used for this analysis, we also introduced a TT-bar inversion mass cut and a repeated cut to kill the symmetric TT-bar backgrounds, which are from the ground-ground fusion. The cross sections and topo symmetries of these benchmark models at the 7TeV LHC are given in the following. The second table is topo symmetry. The number, the numbers in the parenthesis is one sigma statistical uncertainty for five inverse family bar data. And if you check these numbers, you will see the Taptron observations, if they are from new physics, can be confirmed as the early LHC at a similar or even higher significance. So any questions about these numbers?
On the previous slide, your TT bar cross section okay. From these different models seems to be already inconsistent with the data. LHC, there's no K factor, so I don't know.
Yeah, this is leading order.
Okay.
This is leading order. Next slide are the sensitivities of this or part of these leptonic observables. The first table gives the results of the leptonic charge asymmetry, and the second table gives the results of the topolarization, which is in the helicity basis. In our analysis, we analyze all of these observables, but here, because of time limit, here I only present results in the helicity basis. And here, theta is the angle between the helicity basis and the decayed anti-lepton of the top quark. And the last table gives the results of spin correlation, which is based on the top and anti-top polarizations. Here, C1 is top polarization, and C2 is anti-top polarization. And for these models, and for these four models, we see that the numbers in the left-handed axis ground model are relatively small compared to the other ones. The reason is the leptons and anti-leptons, which are decayed from left-handed TT bar are anti-boosted. Okay, I summarize these numbers in this table. In this table, the third represent such an observable which can be measured at whose deviation whose deviation from the standard model prediction can be measured at a 3 sigma or around 3 sigma or larger significant level. So combining these observables, in principle we can distinguish these models at a reasonable level, reasonable significant level. So in summary, the LHC, despite being a PP collider, is actually capable of shedding light on the TT bar AFB anomaly, which has been observed at the Tevatron. Second, the top polarization and the TT bar spin correlation are valuable to distinguish the new phasing models which are used to explain the Tevatron anomaly. And last, at 7 TV LHC, we are able to measure TT AFB and distinguish these models at 3 sigma or higher significance level using 5 inverse sample of data. Yeah, in our analysis for illustration, we only select four benchmark models. Yeah, we know there are Z prime and scalar models, but in principle, we can distinguish these models using other ways. For example, like psi di top, top plus W prime. We can use these decay channels to distinguish these T channel models. Yeah.
So you can maybe reduce the blue-blue contribution a bit, like that for other cuts, and that might help in this case also. You're always looking at YT plus YT bar bigger than T. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
Today or yesterday?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that paper is... that paper basically is following the line of our paper, but they claim that they can improve these results a little more. Yeah. Okay.